Disappearance cases always begin with movement, with phones lighting up and cars rolling out, with people convinced that speed alone can undo whatever has already happened. And I remember how quickly this one filled the air with noise, while answers stayed just out of reach. Because when a teenager vanishes in a place where everyone knows the roads, the silence that follows feels unnatural and heavy. Pershing inside the killer is approved the idea of perceiving the cask as a symbol pre-estate. Slowly, through statements that held just long enough to be tested against land, time, and evidence. When the search stopped being about where she might be and became about what had been done to her, the investigation took on a final shape, one that led to a grave hidden in the woods and a file marked homicide. Her name was Jeray Wilson. Weatherford, Oklahoma is the kind of place where distance can be deceptive, where open land gives the illusion that nothing stays hidden for long, yet isolation can still swallow evidence whole. When I first went through the early materials tied to this case, what stood out was not confusion, but volume. The number of directions investigators were forced to consider, because there was no single clear explanation for why a 16-year-old girl failed to come home. Jeray Wilson disappeared in October of 2012, and in those first days, the case carried the uncertainty common to missing juveniles. There was no immediate crime scene, no confirmed struggle, and no physical evidence pointing clearly toward violence. What investigators had instead were timelines, last seen accounts, and a network of teenage relationships that required careful sorting before anything could be ruled out. Early on, authorities treated the disappearance as serious and potentially dangerous, which meant the case did not remain confined to local patrol work. There were concerns that Jeray may have been trafficked, a possibility that expanded the scope of the investigation and brought in specialized resources. From an investigative standpoint, this decision mattered because it prevented the case from stalling while evidence was still recoverable. As days became weeks and weeks became months, the public-facing side of the investigation grew quiet, which often leads communities to assume nothing is happening. In reality, this is usually the period when investigators are testing statements, identifying inconsistencies, and narrowing the list of people whose accounts cannot be reconciled with known facts. That work rarely produces visible movement, but it lays the groundwork for what follows. During this phase, investigators focused on Jeray's last known movements and the people she spent time with before disappearing. Those reviews did not produce immediate arrests, but they did identify individuals whose proximity to Jeray could not be explained away by coincidence. This is often where patience becomes critical, because premature action can collapse a case before it reaches court. More than a year passed without resolution, and that length of time changed how the case was treated internally. Missing person investigations do not remain static, and as time passes without credible sightings, attention shifts toward locations rather than movement. The land itself becomes part of the investigation. In late 2013, investigators received information that redirected their focus to a wooded area near Weatherford. This was not a random search. It was a targeted response to a specific lead, one that justified committing resources to a remote area where nothing about the terrain suggested it would easily give up what it held. During that search, an investigator located human remains. The discovery was not immediately identified, but it altered the direction of the case permanently. Once remains are found, the investigation enters a different phase, one governed by forensic process and preservation rather than probability. From that point forward, the case was no longer about finding Jeray alive. It was about confirming identity, determining cause of death, and establishing responsibility. The emotional shift is significant, but the procedural shift is absolute. Shortly after the discovery, Tucker McGee was taken into custody. His name was not new to investigators. He had already been interviewed earlier in the investigation, and his connection to Jeray placed him in a position that required closer scrutiny once the case turned toward homicide. As forensic work progressed, investigators began aligning witness statements with physical findings. This is where many cases either solidify or fall apart, because statements must match what the land and the evidence can support. In this case, the alignment began to hold. By the time Jeray's remains were causatively identified, the framework of the case was already forming around a specific narrative, supported by multiple sources. What had once been uncertainty was now a structured investigation with defined suspects, corroborated accounts, and physical evidence tying statements to location. The period before the case changed was long, quiet, and exhausting for everyone involved. But it was also necessary. Without that groundwork, the truth that followed would not have held. There is rarely a single dramatic instant that solves a homicide. Instead, there is a sequence of decisions, each one narrowing the space where lies can survive. In this case, the moment investigators crossed from suspicion into confirmation came through controlled communication and corroborated testimony. Authorities began monitoring conversations between the primary suspect and a cooperating individual. This step is never taken lightly because it requires both legal authorization and confidence that something meaningful will surface. What investigators were looking for was not a confession, but confirmation, language that could be compared against what others had already said. Those monitored conversations did exactly that. They confirmed involvement without relying solely on secondhand accounts, and they gave investigators confidence that what witnesses were describing was consistent with the suspect's own words when he believed he was speaking privately. At the same time, investigators were working backward from the discovery site, mapping how remains could have been transported, concealed, and revisited. This is where witness cooperation becomes decisive, because land does not lie, but it also does not speak without guidance. One individual came forward and admitted being present when Jiray was killed. That admission was not theatrical, but it was precise, describing a shooting in a wooded area and the actions taken afterward to hide the body. The individual later assisted investigators in locating the burial site. Another participant acknowledged providing transportation after the killing, placing himself within the sequence of events that followed the shooting. These admissions did not exist in isolation. They were tested against each other and against physical evidence recovered from the area. The medical examination provided confirmation of what the witnesses described. Jiray had been killed by gunfire, suffering multiple gunshot wounds to the head. The manner of death was ruled a homicide, removing any remaining ambiguity. From an investigative standpoint, this alignment mattered more than emotion. Statements matched location. Location matched remains. Remains matched cause of death. Each piece reinforced the next. As the case moved toward trial, prosecutors relied on the combination of monitored communications, witness testimony, and forensic findings to present a cohesive narrative. This was not a case built on rumor or speculation, but on actions that could be reconstructed and verified. The tape in this case was not a single recording meant to shock, but a tool used to ensure accountability. It allowed investigators to confirm what had already been suggested by evidence and to proceed with confidence that the case would withstand scrutiny. What happened to Jiray could not be undone, but the moment the investigation reached this point, the outcome was no longer uncertain. The question was no longer whether the case would move forward, but how responsibility would be assigned. The trial marked the formal end of the investigation and the beginning of the justice process. A jury heard testimony, reviewed evidence, and returned a guilty verdict for first-degree murder. The sentence imposed reflected the seriousness of the crime and the age of the victim. Later, that sentence was revisited due to legal standards governing juvenile offenders. Because the defendant was under 18 at the time of the killing, the original sentence was modified to allow for parole education after several decades. The conviction itself remained intact. Other individuals involved in concealing the crime faced consequences as well, including prison time and probation, depending on the extent of their participation and their cooperation with authorities. These outcomes reflected how the justice system differentiates between primary responsibility and actions taken after the fact. Beyond the courtroom, the case left a lasting impact on sentencing law discussions within the state, highlighting the tension between punishment, age, and accountability. These debates did not change what happened to Jiray, but they shaped how similar cases would be handled in the future. What remains now is a closed file, a confirmed timeline, and a legal record that documents how a disappearance became a homicide and how that homicide was proven. There is no speculation left, only facts established through investigation and trial. Jiray Wilson was 16 years old, She disappeared in October 2012. Her remains were found more than a year later. She was killed by gunfire. Those responsible were identified, prosecuted, and sentenced according to law. That is where the record ends, not with resolution in an emotional sense, but with finality in a factual one.